all you have to do, in order to be good boys and girls, is just don't use your N-theta facsimiles anymore. And it's very simple, and that's all there is to Dianetics. The rest of the evening, I will tell you a few funny stories. The main thing I want to cover this evening has to do with randomity and emotion. Now, I can cover this in a breath, so to speak, or I can cover it through the axioms. These axioms compare very closely to the subject. They just codify it a little better. And I think if I give you an overall broad picture of what we've got here, you can certainly fit the axioms into it without any trouble, because these axioms are very self-explanatory. Now, one word about these axioms: they are not numbered according to the number they will take in the university issue. That's because there have been a few shifts of position on them, and the axioms which cover the identity of life energy are fewer at the beginning than they are. So it's going to change the numbers on them. Otherwise, with the addition of statics and the operation of statics, this list of axioms is pretty well complete. Now, they cover particularly the aspect of statics and motions. Now, there's an inner subject to the subject of motion, and there's a subject within that one. The first thing about motion is the vectors of effort. All motion could be said to be, one way or the other, efforts, but we don't quite know what starts the effort, so we'll call it motion. We have motions canceling each other, motions changing each other, and we get a varying pattern of that. Here we have a static with no motion, and then following that we have a little motion, probably directed, and then we have that motion splitting up, opposing itself, and so on, until it gets very, very random, and then it gets out into an aligned state so that its vectors are completely parallel and its motion is exactly the same motion over and over, and again we have another static. Now, that's the cycle of motion. Now, we have also volume of motion. You can have two vectors. One is traveling the same as the other, but one is going at a much faster rate of speed, and there's much more there to go into motion. So you can see there's degree of volume of motion. There could be just a little bit of motion or a lot of motion, both aligned the same way. You get that, do you? Here's two motions which are, apparently you'd say they have the same alignment, but they would not necessarily have the same volume. You'd have a little bit of motion, a lot of motion. Now, it's the same way when we talk about degrees of randomity. They start at a static. Say this is a static, and now out here we have a motion, more motion. This would be a volume of the same motion, you see? I mean, you're getting increasing volume of the same motion. You're not getting change of motion. Well, it would come out like this. You could theoretically say it came out in volume until all of a sudden it was starting to paralyze itself and it'd get over here into another static. It would do that with volume, just on the same motion. It could get to such a volume that it would shatter itself, at which moment it'd become a static. There'd be degrees of motion in terms of volume. Now, we're interested in randomity of motion. We're interested in the picture of the vector, the vector system. Now, here we have a static. Now, here we have a motion. It doesn't emanate from that static. It's controlled by the static. And we say we have a motion here that's like that. We've got two factors involved here. Now, that is a line. It's very close to being a static, you see. I mean, it's so aligned that it's awfully close to being a static. But it's not quite a line, so it's not a static. Now, these two vectors are traveling in different, slightly different directions, so we have a slight bit of randomness of these motions. All right. Now, here the motion is getting more random, and here we'll just start breaking up the vectors. Start breaking up these vectors, and notice the vectors themselves start to wobble out of line. Here we've got further randomness, but we have more or less a force in the same direction. We would still at this point be getting something like aligned or orderly motion, because all forces more or less traveling in the same direction. Now, starting to cancel each other out. They're starting to. Here you still have a little randomity, but it'd be getting close to what you could call a static again, because your motion is the same motion, but it's just breaking in opposite directions. You see the various aspects of direction with regard to this. All right, let's take this even further now. You notice that we've still got this. You see, it's not complete static yet, because we've still got these two planes for these split-up vectors to operate in. But supposing this sort of thing started to happen. Right away, you have the pattern of a static. If these things broke down finer, they just break down to dots, by the way. You can keep breaking down these vectors as they go in opposite directions, because they break themselves down in motion. And you just get a series of dots, and when you have a series of dots, they vanish away, and you become a static. So you've got a static again. Now, when you start getting motions like that in volume, it gets to be a pretty jumbled up mess. You've looked at engrams. Well, here is an area, a facsimile, this engram is a facsimile, where all the vectors are splitting up and going in opposite directions, canceling each other, reinforcing each other, stopping each other, changing each other, and so on. Now, if you do that in volume to the individual, look what starts to break down. He has the harmonic motion of his heart. Steady beat. So steady, it's almost a static. He has this harmonic vibration of his heart. It all of a sudden is confronted by a variety of vectors going in all directions, which are both interrupting, reinforcing, and so forth in the vicinity of his heart. Well, you have an engram. If the randomness was such and the volume was high enough to back up into the very seat of consciousness of the body and cancel the aligned motions there and random them. Because notice that any time you send a series of random vectors into an aligned field, random vectors go into an aligned field it n-randoms or makes random the field which was aligned. Take a medical doctor, bring him into Dianetics. He interpolates Dianetics, Dianetics interpolates him, because they're going in opposite directions, almost 100% vector change all the way around. So it's an upsetting picture. I mean, he comes around with his statics, his orientations, his past conclusions, and he doesn't know that these things are pretty random. It's almost a static because it's an authoritarian field. And he comes around, he tells you about this, and it doesn't make sense to you. You, according to him, you're very random because you're not lining up with his vectors. You get a collision, you get in turbulence. Therefore, it's difficult to talk to anyone who has orientation in the field of healing. Not until you go back and pick up his conclusions. There's a very dirty trick you can play on anybody in that field, by the way. All you do is start going back and pick up his agreements to go to school, his agreements to obey the teacher. And if you pick all these things up well, his medical education will collapse. Well, he won't realize it either until it's collapsed. And then, of course, he won't worry about it because it has collapsed. Now, here we have these two things. Here's the volume of motion and the randomness of motion. Any individual is in motion. He is in constant, continuous motion. Most of his motions are aligned. They're fairly well aligned. As a result, when a randomness of motion hits suddenly, which is contrary to his alignment of motion, his motions go out of line. And if the volume of this randomness hitting him is such, he goes anatin. It just simply backs right straight up the nerve channels, hits the control center, knocks it out. It waits to be taken over by another control center. On the epicenter theory, that's what happens. It just nullifies, it quits, it doesn't even record, and it waits to be taken over by the new epicenter. So that you have people standing around, unconscious people, actually operating as their brain center. Evolution sets it up this way. It's a good way to evolve an organism. It's a very poor way to live as a human being. So, randomness is really the opposition of vectors of effort. Automobiles running down the road, its vectors are all aligned in this direction. Another automobile comes down the road, driven by a Kansan. Of course, there's a collision. And it looks awfully random afterwards. Awfully random. Now, this concept has considerable use to you, because it tells you that a society without random motion would be motionless. Because a completely aligned motion is a static. That's a static. It's really not going in any direction at all, but you can put a point on the air and you can say, well, it potentially could go in this direction. It's a static. Optimum randomity would be at a bearable volume which was not completely unsusceptible to alignment. It'd lie somewhere in the middle band. Music, aesthetics depend on randomity. The mind follows along a sound wave in music, where it believes this sound wave is a static, you know? Sousa's band goes over and over for several notes, and it says, ah, nice static. It sits down to relax about this thing, and then all of a sudden the sousaphone kicks in, or the clarinet or something, and adds a new vector, or a new series of vectors. So promptly, person's alerted and says, oh, they keep following it then. And then all of a sudden, it falls off into what appears to be is going toward a static, and then, zing, something else happens. Now, Youngsters who are traveling at a high rate of speed can stand a considerable amount of randomity in their music. They are going at a high rate of speed. They take music at about the same speed, and they are intolerant of even the static of five or six notes following one right after the other on the same level. They're actually intolerant of it. They're even intolerant of a chord like C major. That's church, something like that. C major is not something they want around. So they throw a couple of C flats and sharps and then chop it in sideways with, instead of boom, 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 boom in the bass drum, they boomity boom, 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 boom. And they say, ah, oh, boy, that's music. Well, it's maybe music to them. It's not music to somebody else. Now, you can actually take rhythm, monotonous rhythm, and do things to individuals because you're giving them a static tone. You're giving them a static. So they go into a sort of an hypnotic trance. They see a static, so they're willing to turn themselves over to that static because their emanation point is evidently, as postulated in Dianetics, a static. A monotonous tone and a static is God in a primitive mind. So you introduce just enough action to convince somebody that there is an action happening, and then introduce enough sameness in the action to tell them that there isn't an action happening, that it's not random at all, that it is monotonous. Now, add enough volume to it to impress them with a shock wave on this, and they'll turn themselves over to it. Formulation of the laws of aesthetics is not too difficult now. You can produce that, for instance, stories. Stories follow a curve, follows the interplay of the tone scale, and it a story, for instance, gets its randomness from 1-5 hitting 3-0 usually. And so you have 1-5 and 3-0 and 1-5 and 3-0 and 1-5 and 3-0. And of course 3-0 in a comedy wins, and in a tragedy 1-5 wins. Of course this present school of literature isn't operating quite that way. They operate between 0-2 and 0.9. And everybody's afraid that 0.9 is not going to win, that 0-2 is going to win, and so forth. And when it finally winds up, everybody's very gratified to find out that 0-2 won. The tremendous popularity of 1984, for instance. If you want to write a great novel, a really great novel, for this society at this present time, start it off as though somewhere or other you're going to get into a good, solid 1-5. And about the time people are shocked by having read that the 1-5 is in existence, you start to trail them off. And then at the end of it, why, just don't chop it off with death. No, you see, death has a certain drama. What you do is bring it down to the end of the line at 0-5, and then just indicate that from here on it trails off unbearably for years and years and years, and maybe won't even reach death either. You can sketch the plot of any novel on the tone scale against the time of its plot. Take the tone scale and set it up with a left to right tone vector, and you can sketch the plot. And you can see what the interplay is of the tone scale on it. Then you get an interplay of the dynamics, and then the artist, the writer in the thing, simply injects a randomness so that it doesn't get too monotonous. And you got it. Of course, the artist doesn't, he's always thinking, you know, that he is writing to please himself or some such thing. I notice they all like to eat, though. And he writes for the society, And writers will go out of style, and they never realize why they go out of style, but the society shifts on the tone scale, so that the interplay of the 2 points on the tone scale, high and low, where those 2 points are, he's writing from an era where maybe it was fairly high, and the society has slipped out from under him. And here he is with a beautiful plot that just would have read just fine in 1910, trying to sell it in 1951. Now, a writer will write the same plot over and over, and it will become a static to him. He will become bored with it. Then he'll go around and tell people how he doesn't like writing. All he's got to do is go back and pick up his conclusions that this was the right plot. Remember his conclusions. Now figure out a new plot that plots against the society, and then get in there and murder him. Nothing very difficult about it. In painting, it's the same way. It used to be Maxfield Parrish, and now it's Salvador Dali. He's a great boy. I like his skeletons and things. They please me very much. But only when I'm at the bottom of the time track in an engram, I'm afraid. If you wanted to make a precision science out of the arts, you would not decrease the amount of randomity you could introduce. You would not decrease the amount of effectiveness. What people think would happen if you introduced laws of aesthetics is that all aesthetics would then become static, and they just abhor the idea then. So they keep aesthetics in a somewhat authoritarian field. And it would not be the case if you went along this line with randomity. You just study your randomities, and you could calculate them very, very nicely. And who knows? This 20th century might even yet produce a fiction story. It might. There have been two or three fiction stories produced in the past, but a certain anxiety has come into the publishing field of fiction, has come into the field of painting. Nobody's been able to hit the right degree of randomity to match their audience, and there's the sheriff on the doorstep, and a lot of other minor complications incident to the field of the arts, and individuals then get anxious about it. So they start shooting wildly all over the place. You get cubist painting, modernism, so-called. These are really anxieties. They're neuroses. They're randomnesses which aren't matched up even against themselves. And you, as observers mostly, will look at something by Picasso. And I was at the Picasso show one day, by the way, and guy of Greenwich Village and I went in, and he was wearing a turtleneck sweater, and I didn't know whether it was a hot night. I swelter was right. And I was wearing a business suit, and everybody who was coming to the Picasso show was dressed in tails and ermine wraps and evening gowns, and this was really swell. It was really upstage. He's so thoroughly random that you have to have money to appreciate him. And this artist... So the kid was an artist, and he and I went in there, and we didn't notice until we were quite deep into the thing that this was really a swell gathering. But there were two or three Greenwich Village long hairs around there, so he and I went around, and we just got oblivious of the crowd because they seemed to be milling around somewhat like cattle do when they haven't anything to eat or drink for a number of days. And we went around, and there were three floors of Picasso, and this kid and I would stop in front of each one. I was interested in the neurosis from which Picasso was probably suffering, but more importantly, why was he doing it? And I was coming to the conclusion that it was just a big experiment as far as he was concerned, whereby he was testing color and design lines. And we were going hot and heavy, but this kid would say, "Oh, but no, there is so much soul. There's this, there's that." And I'd say, "No, it just merely looks to me like he's got a libido complex or something." And we got up to the second floor, and he and I had such a falling out about one of the paintings that we reached a static. And we were silent for a moment, and we happened to look around, and we had about 50 people. They had been following us along the line of pictures, listening to us. And boy, they sure looked, some of them were trying hard to look very edified. And so I got very interested in the people who were watching the Picasso show and took a series of notes on it. I wrote an article from the New Yorker, by the way, on it. And one old man, his wife's dragged him there, obviously. He's more interested in textiles or something of the sort. He's going along and he's looking at each picture very, very carefully. And finally, he turns around at the end of the line. I was standing there kind of handy, and he said to me, "You know, he signed every one." Well, this shows you the difficulties of art appreciation if you don't have any kind of a knowledge of randomity. Now, Picasso is random enough, not as random as many of them, but he's random enough to almost be an engram. And people will pay attention to engrams. What you should know about this, then, that it is the interplay of motion in the business of living which makes it possible for an individual to conceive that he is in motion. And when you do not have an interplay of motion, but have a monotony of motion, the individual conceives that he is not in motion, but he is a static. Being a static is being two things. It's being dead, and it is obeying the highest static. So it could be at the same time being dead and obeying survive. The two things can get confused, and they do get confused with preclears. You will find that individuals have almost uniformly confused the staticness of being dead with the staticness of God, to the extent that to believe or think about or have anything to do with God is to be dead. And they will go into apathy on this. And you can resolve quite a few apathy cases simply by going back to the time when they were little kids and somebody really chopped in this concept on them. They put them in apathy. That is not what religion really was supposed to do, I guess. But the point is that here you have, you see, a static here, one there. He just merges the two together. And he says, this is, let's see, God is death. Let's see, and how wrong can I be? That's dead. So therefore, I'm wrong to believe in God. And the only solution to this is to be an atheist. And to go around saying all the time, there is no God. Well, to deny the thing is at least to go into communication with it. You'll get some very interesting confusions with regard to this whole thing. Religion has recognized this many times in the past, and they try to spark up religion by talking about light and other things. For instance, you take Lucifer. Lucifer was the god of Europe before they moved in another god on him. And he then became the devil, which means little god. And nevertheless, the cult of Lucifer, the religion of Lucifer, was trying to overcome this static by saying that it was the motion of flame. They did this also in Persia. And they worked pretty hard to give people a static and then a symbol that isn't static so that they will get into randomness with the religion to the degree that they will move and be able to pay their collection plates. Anyway, no, it's true that it has to be plotted out. Now, if you're going to deal with statics, you have to oppose them with motions or use the static as a means of effecting motion and then give at least as much time to motion as you do to the static. You take professors of history, they all agreed on what Voltaire calls the Mississippi of lies. And there's no randomness about it. Everybody agrees that Napoleon did this, Napoleon did that, and Alexander did this and did that. I don't know that they did. In World War II, I noticed in one battle that The first reports that were coming in ran on this order. Over there on the left, we're smashed to bits. We're advancing in the center. We're advancing on the right. But no, the right has had a very bad setback. Well, I just came from a company on the right, and as a matter of fact, they didn't have a setback. They were advancing. No, another guy says they were standing still. Well, we had a very bad skirmish around that farmhouse up there on Hill 133, and the fellow says that farmhouse isn't on Hill 133. It's over there a little bit further, because I know I was in that action myself, and we were licked. And these good, solid reports are coming in from all directions. And then the battle's all over. At least the enemy is gone. You're not sending forward any more troops. People are bringing out casualties. And the battle's over. 3 days go by. The regimental commanders turn in their reports. These reports do not compare one with another. Not worth a darn. So a higher echelon gets together and looks over these reports, and they decided on what happened. They decided what happened, and this was the story which was issued to the press, and this is the story which will go down in history. But it hasn't anything to do with what happened. Here is an effort to bring randomness into alignment by an authoritative utterance. It's mud from there on down. So, you will find then an individual pining away saying, well, now, I want to leave vaudeville and go and buy me a little chicken farm and settle down and be contented for the rest of my life. Well, God help him if he ever acquires the chicken farm. Because it hasn't got enough randomness in it. But the fellow is using a static goal with which to oppose a life which has too much randomness in it. You know, you're on now, Mr. Smith. Curtain, pack your trunks and leave for Ohio. You know, that sort of a thing. So you got a lot of motion, motion, motion. Guy's going in all directions. His goals aren't defined. Vaudeville's liable to fold up someday. He says he didn't know about television. And so on. So he says, ah, for a nice static. For a nice chicken farm. Sailor, you know, darn fools sailors are. One sailor says, I'm going to put an oar over my shoulder and start walking inland. The other sailor says, why? And he says, well, when I get to a place, when somebody asks me, what's that thing on your shoulder, I'm going to settle down for the rest of my life. Well, sailors have done this, or degrees of it, and they settle down. But after a month or two or three or four, they find themselves back at sea again. And why? Ships are miserable. The sea is a miserable place to be. There's no doubt about this. Ships' officers are at best severe. And yet here's the fellow back at sea. Odd thing. The sea poses, much like the Kansas prairie, a randomness of weather and mood which never lets one get very bored. Here you go, on the prairie or on the sea. You don't quite know what's going to happen next in the way of weather. Well, that introduces a randomness. Furthermore, destinations can be shifted and all sorts of things can happen. Here is action. Individuals, by the way, who will seek physical action as an outlet or a desire for randomness, generally fairly healthy, but they back up to a point where they will only read about looking for it. And they will go to the office at 9 and get off at 5 and in the office at 9 and off at 5 and into the office at 9 and off at 5, day after day. No randomness about it at all. Now, they might say, I wish I could go down to the South Seas and sit on a small island for the rest of my life and do nothing but eat coconuts, something like that. That's one response. There is another response to exactly the same thing. This response has its source in a static existence. The fellow says, I wish I was dead. No difference, you see. It's very easy, then, for a paradise to be a static which is a point where there is unending and unendurable pleasure, as in the Mohammedanism, and for a fellow to be dead when he's there. Now you see how this thing figures out. It's a static, so they pose everything that has to do with the static. A fellow can go into a static then by doing the same action too many times over. That's very interesting, as I was talking about last night, about training, various other factors. Randomness starts from a static, and then we don't have volume. Low volume can get into all sorts of interplays here, and people will enjoy it. Gets into high volume of motion, get over here towards center, and it's an engram. So it isn't motion that makes the engram, it's volume of motion. You get the idea. Here's a fellow stands up and all of a sudden, bow! Bullet hits him. Something like that. He has struck too much randomness at the moment to support. Now, the whole subject of randomness, randomity, would be incomplete without understanding that it is nothing more nor less than randomity, which is pain. Pain is randomity. It is a variety of randomity. It has volume, and it damps out aligned motion. Anything which has volume and damps out an aligned motion is pain. So therefore, people talk about mental pain as well as physical pain. Fellow puts his hand on a hot stove, stove's vibrating at such and such a rate, the cells in his fingers are vibrating at such and such a rate, he withdraws his hand. Because the randomity of the stove has cut down the motion of his fingers. It has speeded it up to zero, or it has slowed it down to zero. It doesn't matter which way you go, you reach zero on randomity. Zero motion or a static. Pain is always loss of aligned motion. The loss of aligned motion is always pain. The effort of the individual to hold on to an aligned motion causes him to hold on to the pain. He will actually hold on to the randomity because he doesn't want it to go. Now, what life does with motion in general, it also does with pain, because pain is merely an intensified and more random motion. The first thing that life does about pain, I read you this the other day, throws it back and employs it as conquered, converted effort. See, it gets motion coming in here and throws it right on out again. Now, a man's pretty good. He can post his mind out here someplace and some motion comes along, and he's learned to handle machines and things, so he can change the direction of this motion. That's one. Something comes in and touches him. He re-diverts it or redirects it as his first effort. His first effort is catch it and throw it away. Very important what I'm telling you now, because you're going to be looking for just this point above other points in the middle of effort processing. In comes pain with volume. His first effort's throw it away. If it comes in deeply, a little more deeply than that, he feels it a little more intensely, he says to himself, sort of, I can't use this, but I'll damp its action and throw it away. You see, it must be moving too much randomity in it for him to handle its action and throw it away, so he'll bring it in and damp its action and throw it away. But the dampening of the action permits him to throw it away. Again, see, get rid of it. Push the stove away. Do something with this effort. The next step is to hold it and dampen it in the hope that he will then be able to throw it away. In will come a pain source, and the guy says, damp out. He'll knock off the motion on it. He's using his motion to counter its motion. And the mind will actually direct an impulse toward doing each one of these steps. And you will be able to find that impulse in effort processing. Now, the pain comes in, and it's too much for him. He holds it all right to damp it out as a motion, and it overwhelms his control center. The control center at this moment says, I have been superseded. The War Department has just sent in a new general, and a sort of out of randomity waits for the new order to take over. Now, if unconsciousness takes place, the control center is, to some slight degree, superseded. People then making statements, doing other things around this individual are in control of him at the moment. Because you see your evolution of epicenters. Each epicenter came into being in just this fashion. A great number of these pains brought in, overwhelmed the individual, took over. Now the next step, if he's trying to hold this pain, he finds out he can't do anything about it to dampen it out, so he tries to speed up or slow down in some fashion to equalize with it. This is the source of change of position on the tone scale, his effort to equalize with these counter efforts. He may also adopt this course. He may take a local effort area and take the pain and say, we will now, he'll go out of contact with the area of the pain. The pain will come in, boom. Then you go out of contact with the area while it holds the pain. Nice system, you see. Therefore, a fellow can go out of contact with his knees. Knees hurt severely, goes out of contact with them. Blood flows through them. The knees are now cut off of a supply line. Everything else, they're just being denied by the control center. Control center says, I'm still damping out the pain in that area. And it says, so you get arthritis. The last thing that the body does with this incoming pain, this incoming vibration, we can use those words interchangeably, pain, vibration, randomity with volume. Incoming pain, he finds out he can't throw it back. He can't hold it and damp it. He can't localize off the area. He does these steps successively. He says, well, maybe he can't equalize, you know, cut its vibration down a little bit and raise his own a little bit and so live with it, or raise its vibration a little bit, raise his own vibration a little bit and come up with it to equalize with it slightly. He can't do these things. He then finds that his own organism is going into the vibration rate and the randomity rate of that pain. And that is to succumb. The next step down there is apathy. Then is where a new control center can really be thrown in. That is a real good engram. Command center is out. The body has succumbed to a new rate of motion. It's overwhelmed. Cannot persist against this. Immediately down the tone scale goes the individual's belief in his effort to control his environment. Because he cannot handle, start, and stop the motion in that environment. He can't do this, therefore his tone comes down. A person's tone goes down in direct ratio to his belief in his ability to handle motion. A person must be, you could also say this, dangerous to motions. By this, any motion that comes in his direction will either be used or kicked straight away. Now, that's being dangerous. A person considers he has good self-confidence when he feels this way. Doesn't matter what motions of a hostile nature came into his environment, he would immediately be able to damp them out, convert them, get rid of them. He can handle them. Only when those motions have swamped him a few times does the command center say, well, we had high hopes that this life would be the one, but it obviously isn't. Have to evolve to a newer form. Now, I read those over rapidly and check your notes on. The first thing he does is try to throw it back and employ it as a conquered, converted effort. Two, throw it back with its action damped. Three, hold it and dampen it. Let it in, but channel it. Next is try to equalize with it, endure. Five, suffer it localized and let it destroy that localized area. Six, succumb to its vibration rate. Agree, then, to the counter-effort motion is the same thing. It's taken over. It's now the thing, and it believes on this level. Now, it's interesting that an individual's operation and action in life with thought and with the activities of other people around him compare right on this tone scale. The fellow's fairly well up the tone scale. Somebody comes along with a lot of chit-chat this way or that. He chucks it back in their teeth. Very cheerfully sometimes. He's way up the tone scale. Why, you tell him almost anything, call him almost anything, you find yourself rocked back in your heels. He just takes the smart cracks, something like this. Well, he'll hand out four or five times the smart crack volume. It's dangerous to chitter-chat around with an individual like that if one has a thin skin, because he doesn't care much what he turns back. Anything that'll come at him, even faintly, on too much randomity basis. He can handle a lot of randomity. This individual will also aid and assist an aligned effort. He's good at that. But anything that would threaten to be or would ever become pain, whether verbal or in action in his environment or in actual physical contact, he'd handle it in that fashion. Your next level, he'd have a tendency to become antagonistic, angry. In comes the pain, and only there's no great lift to it. He says, you're not so hot either, that sort of thing. The next step down the tone scale is endure. And that's below 1.5. But endurance, because there is randomity, as long as the person's alive, has these occasional resurgences. So they'll try to flick back a little bit of this pain. Well, that's covert hostility. Get down a little lower, the person just goes into grief. And when they hit 6, they succumb to its vibration rate. They're in apathy. Compare your hypnotic band. Compare your hypnotic band with this band. And more important, compare emotion with motion. Emotion and motion are interdependent, and emotion is nothing more than the rate and randomness of the motion. It has a mechanical aspect depending upon glands and physical structure. Has an aspect of muscular tension or lack of tension. So that you can add a couple, three new columns on the tone scale. One of them is muscular tension. The individual is in the process of throwing it back. Well, this is resilience. His muscles will have a resilience. They can still operate on a more or less optimum basis. The next point, of course, is where he's damping it a little bit and sending it back. You know, conservatism? Now, there's a little more tension in the muscles in order to do that. Now, as the motion comes in and is held and damped, you have depository illnesses. 1.5. Held. Anger. Destroy. What he's trying to do is destroy emotion. Emotion. And his emotion to destroy it is manifested as anger. Get the muscular tension. It's clamped down on this sort of thing. It's the muscle-bound sort of reaction. You'd never get a high 1.5 elan of destruction. A person doesn't go out all loose-muscled and lace things up. Mm-mm. No. Destruction, when accomplished out of an emotional band at 1.5, is almost a muscle-bound proposition. It's blunt. It's ineffective, inefficient, so on. because the muscular reaction isn't loose. It can't even let go its motion. If you realized this when you were kids and got in a flock of fights, you really could have fixed people up. All you had to do was not get mad and get the other fellow very mad, and if you got him mad enough, he wouldn't even be able to hit you so the blow would sting. Because if you get a person mad enough, they'll congeal. They'll just freeze. And what they're trying to do is dampen motion with their own muscles, so you get on that band. Now, the next level down is equalize with it. I hear you're getting resilience. You tell this person so-and-so, they agree with you quickly. There's no reason, no real ARC in it. You say, blackberries are red when they are green. They'll say, yes, yes, absolutely, you're wonderful. You start vibrating on the rate of, oh, I'm so sad. They say, I'm so sad. In other words, their motion will go into your motion rate. Because, you see, thought is merely extensional motion. Thought is formed by earlier actions. A person can be punished down to this line, then, of belief in just one thing, belief that they say they have to agree. Well, the way belief in having to agree comes about is just this, being put at a vibration rate in life where any motion that comes along, they have to vibrate to it. Some fellow comes along to an individual at 1-1, and he's got a psychosomatic illness. This individual has psychosomatic illness, he comes up to a 1-1, psychosomatic illness, has, bang, he's got it, bang, whatever it is. Because he's got to go along on this same emotional rate. Emotion, motion. The emotion merely denotes the degree and ability of the individual to handle motion. That's all. If you want to put anybody on the tone scale, any place you want to put them, you just give them this kind of motion. Start giving them the kinds of motion they have to dampen. You'll make a 1-5. Give them the kind of motion they have to agree to. You'll make a 1-1. Give them the kind of motion that they try to localize it and chop off various parts of their body to, and they'll come down to about 0.8. And if you fix it up so that when they get a motion, they have to vibrate to it, you get a 0.5. All you got to do is take a little kid. Every time he tries to initiate a motion, don't let him. Make him succumb. And as long as he wiggles, hold him. Any effort he tries to put forward, wiggle, get out from under anything else, squash it, dampen right there. You can make a 0.5, tailor-made, just by doing that. Just keep that up for a few months. Little kid wants to go here. Oh, no, stop him. Stop him. Now he still tries to go there. Really brace him back and give him a counter motion for every motion he tries to make. And you'll eventually get him to a point where all you'll have to do is say, well, jump. He'll jump. You can get him to a point where he's normal. Now, you can put this kid down on a 0.4, 0.3 level simply on the basis of every time he makes a move, knock him out. Simple. Effective is knock him out every time he makes a move that you don't like or something of the sort, or that appears to be a free motion on his part. He makes a motion, knock him out. Simple. He will wind up in pretended death because you have approximated death so often. All death is succumbing to a motion rate and going all. Everything starts vibrating in agreement with the motion which is assaulting the individual. When an individual goes into death throes, he's ordinarily merely dramatizing a past death where limbs were actually moved just exactly as they are moving in death throes. You want to make a study of that sometimes, nice cheerful subject. And it's by the way, you'll be making a study of it whether you like it or not. Now, there is emotion. It quite by accident matches up as emotion and motion. It's quite by accident that these two words match up. Just a fluke. But somebody, someplace, back down the track in the English language said, you know, there's something similar between these two things. And it doesn't compare that way in other languages that I know about. But there's the key to the problem. Now, if you want to find an individual's position on the tone scale, test his muscles. They will be that much above or below optimum, fast or slow side, as to denote what he's trying to do with motion. You can also pick out where a guy's stuck, because the whole band of the tone scale is not really a summation of what overall happens to the individual so much as where he's stuck in what. And you could pick out whether or not he has already succumbed to the motion or what point of the engram he is in by the residual tension in his muscles. Evidently, the muscular reaction is what monitors glands. Made a study of glands for about a year. Found some very interesting things about them. They won't buck the mind. They won't even begin to. You give a guy big shots of adrenaline, something like that, you get this kind of a reaction. Here's normal. You give him a shot. Only keep on giving shots. Give a shot here, 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 here. Same mouth, same shot. Give him the same shot. Give him all of those shots in sequence over that many days. And this is how adrenaline will act on him. It very shortly, goes down below normal and then equalizes on his residual muscular tension. Over, under, flat. Works out with testosterone, works out with estrogen, works out with pituitary extract, whole pig armors. It's fascinating. You've got just about as much chance of monitoring a human being with glandular extract as you have flying on the moon on a washboard. Yes?
What happens when it's cut off? Do you get another...
Oh, when it's cut off, that's grim. You can practically kill a man with it. You can practically kill a man. You just give him glandular extract, heavy quantities of it until he equalizes on a heavy quantity of it. What he's doing is he's cut down his own secretion from that gland, and he's cut that down, and he's also inhibiting the intake and doing things with that. By the way, glandular injections make cysts more often than not. The body just walls the stuff up. Doesn't want anything to do with it. And then all of a sudden you take him off of it. Wham! And then the body gradually comes back and recovers. You do almost anything you want with glandular extract over a short period of time. Very short period of time. What evidently happens with the glands is there are two monitor systems. The pituitary up here evidently has little catalysts that are thrown into the bloodstream by the mind, by thought, something of the sort, and they trigger the gland. The other system is simply body tension. You get enough tension on the body and it'll squirt out so much adrenaline. It's probably as simple and elementary as that. If the second one were true, you should be able to massage a glandular area and increase the amount of glandular secretion in the area. I don't know that anybody ever tried it, because what you do is just try to get a person with diabetes to get well simply by massaging the pancreas. Who knows? Doctors don't. Well, anyhow, I want you to put 5 stars on this motion-me-motion proposition for this excellent reason, as I will go into in the second part of tonight's talk. This is the way you take apart the effort in an engram. The key to it The key to the emotion of the individual, the key to the whole process, is motion, emotion, and the interplay of epicenters. And you get those three items, you've got them down pat, you start to take an engram apart, nothing to it. This is all you're shooting for, really, in engrams. Okay, let's take a break.